accession number 13923, reel 1.
Mr. Hudson, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Birmingham.
Which year was that?
1920.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a carpenter.
Self-employed?
No, he was the local council carpenter.
Did you go to school in Birmingham?
Yes. All the schooling was done in Birmingham.
Which part of Birmingham?
Lady Wood.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
In 34?
34, that's it.
Did you get a job?
I had a job immediately. One of the schoolmasters got me a job. I left school Friday, started work on Monday morning.
As what?
This was an apprentice engineer.
What were you doing when war broke out?
When war broke out, I'd got a job as a chauffeur with a local firm, with, you know, taking the managing director around, etc. And of course I was also a member of 605 Squadron, which I joined in late 37.
Why had you joined 605 Squadron?
Well, this is rather strange, because normally I don't think anybody knew about 605 Squadron really, but this, I eventually worked on a farm for about 12 months, and the son was a member of 605 Squadron. Being a farmer, he couldn't afford the time to attend the squadron, weekend camps and evening lectures, etc. So I went with him just for the ride, for him to hand his kit back in at the aerodrome, and this is how I found out about the squadron. So eventually I thought, I'd like to have a go at this business. It was really a glorified flying club. I thought, this is a cheap way to fly. So this is what I did. I joined 605, and the only job, hadn't got enough qualifications to be a pilot. I could be an air gunner or an air photographer. So I thought, knowing something about photography, I chose to be an air photographer.
What did it involve in those days?
Well, this really involved, it was a weird, we didn't have a flying rank of any description, we didn't even have a logbook. But what it meant is, somebody wanted to take photographs from the air, they called upon the photographic section to supply a photographer plus camera, etc., then develop and print it, and then give the finished article back to the officer, or even for the Air Ministry for that matter.
What kind of equipment did you have then?
Well, strange enough, the main air camera that we used in the air was an F-24, which was in use up till a few years back. It was a very fine camera, really, but of course it's nothing like the modern cameras. I mean, they're absolute super jobs.
And did you just lean over the side or something?
Well, you could do it two ways. You could strap it in a hole in the floor of the aircraft, which was under the pilot's seat, lie down flat, and just, you know, press the button every now and then when you wanted to take the photograph, or just switch it on automatic and it would run along while you did what we called overlaps, a long string of photographs, which were then put together. So they form one massive photograph, and then you would take another photograph of the whole lot, so you'd got half of England on one photograph. That was the other method was over the side, which were called obliques, which were very dodgy because the camera was heavy, the lens was quite long, and if the wind got into the lens, it could quite easily have torn it out of your hands. So you had to be very careful with obliques, but that was a much happier way of taking photographs, leaning out of the cockpit. It was a much happier way of taking photographs.
Why much happier?
Well, you felt more like a photographer with a camera, you know. The other thing was, the other one was attached to the aircraft. You were merely pressing a button and just watching where you were. I mean, we weren't taught navigation. It was up to the pilot. I mean, he just flew over and you took the photographs. So I think if we'd have been taught navigation, it would have been a lot more interesting for us, you know.
Did you ever lose a camera over the side?
Oh, no. I never come to any damage. The only thing I ever did, which I was chastised about before any damage was done, on a very hot summer's day, I put the camera down. Now, the easiest way to put the camera on the floor was with the magazine and the lens pointing up, and the sun was out. In no time at all, it would have set fire to the film, but luckily one of the sergeant photographers was there and told me off about it, that, you know, I must never put a camera on the floor with the lens pointing to the sky. So nothing happened with that one either.
What kind of people were in the squadron in the late 30s?
Basically, they were all really very skilled men, you know, in their own jobs in the factories in Birmingham. And the regulars on the squadron were really there to teach you, you know, the Air Force trades. But I think they had a very easy job because, I mean, we've got lads that worked in tool rooms and things like that. They were actually better trained than the Royal Air Force fitters and riggers, you know. They had a lot more experience with all sorts of weird jobs. In fact, we often did alterations to things the Air Ministry had issued, and they were much better. And then when the Air Ministry caught up with us and said, "What the hell's this?" they immediately adopted them. You know, it was one of those things. You've got lads who worked in huge factories like Lucas's, Austin, and places like that, Dunlop. They were making the things the Air Force was using, you see, so it was a wonderful experience for them, really, to be in the Air Force.
What were relations with the pilots like?
Very good, very good. We had, I would say, 100% cooperation in all respects with the pilots. I don't think, we never had what you could call an overbearing officer. I mean, again, the majority of those were civilians, and most of those were in trades. Jerry Edge, him and his brother ran a big engineering company in Wolverhampton, you see. So that it's nobody trying to pull these lads' legs. They were far better, far more experienced in business and engineering particularly than anybody was. So that we weren't quite as strict as the regular airmen, you know, when we were working on aircraft. And yet we still had very strict parades and things like that, which were up to, you know, anybody's standard, really.
Did you think at that time that you would be involved in a war?
Not really. I don't think we thought about it, really. I've always considered that it was a sort of a very serious flying club for everybody. I don't think anybody gave any thought until the first inkling, I think, was there was something happened in 38, wasn't there?
The Munich crisis.
I think that was because we were called up and we had to, you know, arm the aircraft and get bombs ready, you know, because we were a bomber squadron, and we realised, you know, there was something was afoot. But when it died away, we went back to being quite casual again, really. I should think it was about a month before we were called up that we realised we were really in trouble. Because we were called up on the 15th of August, 1939. We'd just come back from the annual air firing camp at Tangmere. And, well, we were only in the house like Saturday. We arrived home Saturday, and Monday morning we got the mobilisation papers. So that, then, I mean, we knew we were in trouble then, all right.
Would you have joined 605 if you had known that a war was coming?
Oh, I think so. I think once you'd, there was a wonderful spirit amongst the squadron, you know. Between the auxiliaries and the regulars, there was a fantastic feeling of comradeship that, well, I'd never experienced anything like it. I'd worked in factories, I'd worked on a farm, and I'd mixed with people, and I'd never come across this feeling of everybody sort of looking after each other. definitely the first time that had happened to me.
You said it was a bomber squadron. What planes were you flying just before the war started?
We'd got Hawker Hines, two-seater day bomber. Hawker Hines, and I think they could, they, at a push, they'd get, you could get 200 mile an hour out of them, but it was a push, you know. It was. It had only got a 650 sort of horsepower engine, the Kestrel, and it carried four 100-pound bombs, I think they were, and one Vickers gun and one Lewis gun fired into the rear, so it wasn't particularly, you know, heavily armed or anything like that.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, again, it's quite difficult to... I don't think we were we weren't, you know, over the moon sort of business, but I think most of us felt, you know, it was about time that we had a go at this bloke Hitler, and that was it.
Did you feel confident about Britain's prospects against Germany then?
Oh, I think so then. I mean, to be honest, we didn't know what sort of trouble we were in. I mean, aircraft-wise alone, we'd had some Gladiators delivered to us, which were then taken off us, and then the Hurricanes came. But we really didn't know much about the German Air Force, that's the truth of it. Not the ordinary airmen, anyway.
What happened to you on mobilisation?
Well, we went from Castle Bromwich to Tangmere in Sussex, which was our war station, as it were. Every auxiliary squadron had a war station to go to in the event of a war. And Tangmere was ours, so we went to Tangmere.
What happened there?
Well, utter chaos for a while, because they were calling hundreds of reservists up, and most of these people were totally unfit for service, but they'd got to sort of give them a medical and discharge them. And we slept in the hangar for, I think, one or two nights. Then when they'd cleared all the reservists out, we moved into the billets there, the ordinary airmen's billets, and that was it.
Were you the only squadron there?
No, who was the other one? 43 squadron, fighter squadron was there, which was a very old RAF, regular RAF squadron, and treble one squadron.
You said that you became an armourer in this year.
That's right, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, if I didn't, being a photographer, if I wanted to stay as a photographer, I'd got to leave the squadron, you see. It no longer had a photographic section. Fighter squadrons didn't carry a photographic section, only bomber squadrons, which meant I would leave the squadron. I'd, you know, obviously lose all my friends. So I decided, rather than do that, because by this time I'd also got to know some of the armourers, I remustered as an armourer, so I could stay with people I knew.
So you had to be retrained as an armourer?
Oh yes, I had to be retrained, and eventually I was sent to the Air Armament School at Manby for, you know, a complete conversion course.
How did you like being an armourer?
Well, it's the best trade in the Air Force.
Why?
Fitters and riggers, they're nobody, and pilots are nobody. What happens? The guns and the bombs, they do the damage to the enemy. So we always regard ourselves, as a matter of fact, very rude of us, of course, but I've told Group Captain Edge knows about this, we regarded them as chauffeurs for our guns and bombs. It's true.
Was there any aspect of the job that you didn't like?
No, I don't know, it was a very satisfying job in lots of ways. I mean, later on, you know, when the air battles really started, this business of rearming the aircraft and refueling them, well, I mean, we got this rearming business down to a real tight thing. I mean, two or three minutes, the guns would be rearmed and we'd be off the plane. usually the people putting the petrol in was after finishing, after we'd gone. And this was essential because you can't have an aircraft sitting on the aerodrome when you're being, there's a raid on, in case they decide to attack the aerodrome, and then you lose your aircraft on the ground, which of course are useless. So that we were a very good crowd, really. I know it might sound strange to say it, but we totally ignored all other trades in the Air Force. I don't know whether we considered them below us or what. They were always a bit wary of us, because until you've been trained to use guns and bombs and mess about with them, I mean, you get to a stage where you get very lax with it sometimes. I mean, you know it's going to go off if you do the wrong thing, but you get used to them. Well, these other lads, if they see you rolling bombs about, they scarper, they don't want to know. So that we did have a very wonderful spirit in the armour, there's no doubt about that. We were regarded as the biggest scroungers, of course, because we could always get out of parade by saying there were some bombs that had got to be moved. Well, that had got to happen before you had a parade. We had a flight sergeant, hated the sight of us, but there was nothing he could do about it, because he couldn't let us leave bombs lying around when we would say they'd got to be put in a bomb store and we could take all day moving them. So that, in a way, we were a very independent lot, really. We never mixed with the other lads. We didn't go drinking with them. Armours always drank, you know, with themselves in the local villages.
Did you ever have any accidents yourself with weaponry?
No, we never had an accident with a gun or a bomb. Not that anybody got hurt. I suppose the big thing that happened to us, that we had an aircraft hand. This is an airman who's not been trained for anything. He's sort of a labourer. Eventually he'll get trained, but until then he's a labourer for you. And we, at the beginning of the war, they hadn't given any thought to put an aircraft out on the aerodrome, spreading them out so they couldn't all get bombed together. And consequently, right at the beginning of the war, you'd got aircraft put back in the hangars every night like they did in peacetime, which was totally stupid, of course, because one bomb on the hangar and the lot's gone. And consequently, we serviced them in the hangars, you know, all very nice and warm. Afterwards, of course, you've got to do it out in the fields. But this day, we were cleaning the guns on a Hurricane in the hangar at Tangmere. And this aircraft hand, I don't think anybody spotted him, or they might have said, don't go in the cockpit, but he got in the cockpit. Now, whether the firing button had been left on, or whether he turned it to on, he was too shaken to be able to describe anything. The lads cleaning the guns with cleaning rods, metal cleaning rods, as both airmen on both wings went down to pick up another fresh piece of 4B2, the guns went off, and the whole lot went, which is, you're talking about 350 rounds out of 8 guns each. The whole lot went. He was literally paralysed with his hand on the firing button. He couldn't lose it. And of course, you can imagine this terrific row in the hangar with the hangar doors shut. You know, we were full of smoke. Everybody was dashing around to see who was dead, and nobody had been hurt. The hangar door had virtually been blasted away. And, of course, that was that. It was almost years afterwards we found out that some of the rounds had hit the weathercock on Chichester Cathedral. And the bullet holes are still in it to this day. And I don't know whether do you remember a programme, Down Your Way, on a Sunday?
Yes.
I forget who did it now, but this lad went to Chichester Cathedral, and this is only talking about 8 or 9 years ago, and he asked the parson what was the story about the bullet holes in the weathercock. And this chap said, oh, some bloody fools did it during the war. So obviously he didn't know who'd done it, really. But because it was an aircraft in a flying position, it wouldn't have done that. But as it was in this position when the guns fired, the bullets went through the top of the hangar door and straight over, which is nearly 2 miles to Chichester, and put some bullet holes in the weathercock, which they felt it wasn't worth repairing, so it's still like it today. But that's the only, you know, accident. I mean, there could have been two men with their heads blown off straight away, but it was just sheer luck. They both bent down at the same time to pick up a fresh piece of 4x2 to clean the guns with.
When did this happen?
Oh, that'd be 39, September, August, September, October. It'd be about October, end of October, 1939, because we left Tangmere shortly after that.
To go where?
Oh, no. You've got... We went almost everywhere in the British Isles.
Oh, more important, where were you when the balloon went up, when the fighting really started in France in May?
Well, we started off, we went to Tangmere, and then in 1940 we went up to Lucas, February, Wick. Then we went down in May to Hawkinge, and of course, this was the Battle of the Dunkirk lot. That's when it really got a bit nasty. We lost quite a few pilots at Hawkinge. We ourselves, we were in a bit of trouble at Hawkinge because there was no billets for us to go in, so we slept under the wings of the aircraft. And there was no cookhouse. The cookhouse had been blown to smithereens. So food in the form of sandwiches was brought to us. Food was in the form of sandwiches, corned beef sandwiches. There was nothing else. We occasionally got a cup of tea. The station had been heavily bombed, and of course it was in a shocking state. But we only lasted about 4 days there because we lost so many pilots and aircraft. So we moved then from Hawkinge back to...
Were there any attacks on Hawkinge in the 4 days you were there?
No. No, the Germans were too busy trying to do the lads on the beaches, of course. We were... Our patrols, mind you, don't forget... A lot of people forget this. Our fighter patrols were not only going for trying to protect the lads on the beach, they were going 20 miles inland, attacking the German columns to try and protect the lads retreating to Dunkirk. And this is where, of course, where we lost a lot of lads. They ran out of petrol and were shut down and one thing or another.
Sorry, you said you were only at Hawkinge 4 days?
About 4 days, that's all, yeah.
And then to...?
Then we went back to Scotland to... After we went back up to Drem at Edinburgh, outside Edinburgh, to reform, because we virtually... non-existent as far as aircraft and pilots were. And from there...
This was because of the 4 days at Hawkinge?
The 4 days at Hawkinge just literally reduced us to nothing. It was a terrible affair, really. Again, you see, I'm not a pilot, but it's pretty obvious what was the trouble was. I mean, the lads were outnumbered about 20-1. I mean... ME-109s were flying in formations of 40 and 50, and our people were going out in 4s and 5s. You know, there was no chance, really, to have a decent fight. They'd got to pick a lone German, you know, to do any good, because attacking the bigger formations was suicide.
How was morale in the squadron affected?
Not very good. It was not very good then, because... You know, you get a bit fed up of seeing lads flying off and not coming back. And all around us was disaster. There was a Lysander Army Corporation squadron, well, not a squadron, about 4 aircraft, operating from Hawkinge. Now, I do know for a fact, certainly at least one air gunner on one of these Lysanders, he actually didn't know how to fire the gun. He'd been told to go and become an air gunner. And one of our lads, Corporal James, I saw him climbing up, talking to this lad, and I thought, what's he doing? And Jamie came back. I said, what on earth are you doing? He said, the poor devil, he doesn't know how to fire the gun. He said, I've got to give him a chance. And these Lysanders were coming back. The pilots were okay, But the poor old air gunners were all dead, because there was no... Pilot had a sheet of armour plating behind his back. But the air gunner, of course, had nothing, only fabric. So he was being picked off, you know, immediately by these German fighters.
Did you get very upset about what was happening?
Well, I think you got more angry than upset, you know. Everybody was saying, what the bloody hell's the matter with the Air Ministry sort of business, you know. Why don't they know what we're up against and things like that?
So you tended to blame the Air Ministry?
You definitely blame, you know, the air command sort of business. You couldn't blame anybody else because our aircraft were in the same condition as they'd always been. The pilots were just as good. In fact, the pilots were better than when the war started. And yet here we were, losing them left, right and centre. So it had got to be, you know, there was something wrong. And of course, if you read a lot of books after the war, you find that... This 13 group that was held in around Cambridge and that, they didn't want to commit all our fighters to this fight. You know, they wanted to hang on because they realised, I suppose somebody must have realised, sooner or later this Battle of Britain was going to come on. You know, and the sole defence really was going to be the Air Force for a few months. So I suppose in a way they were doing the right thing, but at the time it didn't seem as though they were, you know. To us it seemed as though we were being ignored a little bit at this stage in the game. If they'd have pushed them all in, we'd have lost a lot. There's no shadow of doubt about that. There's no way we could have... The only way they could have done it was pretty well match the Germans with the same amount of fighters. Well, that could have meant a draining of all the fighters. I don't think our aircraft factories had really got cracking in those days. The strangest thing is that when we went to Drem, Trenchard came up to Drem to talk to us, because it's not only us, it spoke to a lot of squadrons who had been mauled in this Dunkirk lot. And his pep talk really was to say that he'd been in much the same position in April 1918, the German Air Force was knocking hell out of the Royal Flying Corps, and more or less, not to worry, it'll come all right, you know. And he did. He said something like, in a few days you'll have all the aeroplanes you want. Well, we thought, that's a bit of flannel, you know, that's never going to happen. But within, I think, of 2 or 3 days, these huge lorries came up with crates on the back, and they were all brand new Hurricanes from Canada. They'd been made in Canada. And within 10 days, you know, the squadron was reformed with all new aircraft, new pilots, and we were ready, you know, ready again. And of course, obviously, on top of the world with this lot again.
But had you seen anything of the men coming back from Dunkirk?
Well, in Folkestone, yes, the army lads were very. They're very angry, really, because their favourite saying was, where was the bloody Air Force? Well, the bloody Air Force was 20 miles inland, getting hell knocked out of them, trying to stop the bombers getting to the beaches. Had the bombers got at the beaches, they wouldn't have survived. Nothing would have survived, as bad enough as it was. But if the hindcalls and that, if they'd have got through to the beaches, well, and Stukas, I mean, some did get through. But you're talking of if 40 or 50 had got through in one raid, that had decimated the beaches. And now you can't blame the army lads feeling that they were deserted, but they weren't by any means. The Air Force was taking a hell of a licking, but nobody was shouting about it.
Did you meet any of the army at Folkestone?
Oh, they weren't very happy. There was an occasion, I didn't witness it, where some soldiers threw some tins of corned beef at some airmen, like everything else, they got over it eventually, you know, it was forgotten, sort of. Although I still get soldiers, old soldiers of my own age, who still pull you, well, they pull your leg about it, you know, where the bloody hell were you at Dunkirk and all this.
Does it annoy you still?
Not really, because